Chris Bowen, would you read for us, please, Job chapter 20, and read for us verses 12 through 19, please. Okay. Zophar uses some rather expressive language here. He was kind of bland, I think, in his first speech. He's a little more specific, a little more than vanilla in his first speech. He didn't say a whole lot of anything the first time around, but he's getting a little more specific now in his insinuations and his accusations against Job. The wicked sweet that he enjoys will actually end up bitter. Is his main argument here. He will relish this taste in his mouth, but in his stomach it will turn to bitterness. And as he sees it, who will turn the sweet to bitter? God's going to do that. God will not allow the wicked to persist in their wickedness and enjoy at last or finally enjoy their ill-gotten gains. God will see to that that they are punished in some way. That's really what Zophar is saying. And what I really want to stress here is look in verse 19. Here is an insinuation, I believe, a strong insinuation, talking about the wicked. And of course, anytime the friends were making an insinuation, it's of course obviously against who? Well, they're talking to Job, obviously. But look what he says. For he has oppressed and forsaken the poor. He has seized a house which he has not built. What's he implying about Job? Yes, but who do they think is the wicked person? They think Job is wicked. Now, he could be talking about the wicked in general. You are correct, Harold. But their argument really, the whole time, has been centered on Job. That is true. That is true. Yes. So let me rephrase my question. If this be speaking about Job, and I think that it is, you may disagree, and that's okay. But if this is an insinuation against Job, then what is he implying about Job? Right. Now, that's right. And look at the passages on the chart up there. Go back to chapter 1 real quickly, and you look at verse 3, verses 9 and 10, and verse 21. Verse 3, how was Job described? The last phrase in verse 3, greatest man in the East. Anybody greater than Job? Look at verses 9 and 10. Where did Satan say that he got the blame? These things which thou hast given him. Job didn't gain them dishonorably. At the end of the chapter, when Job is lamenting after those four visits, and he loses everything in just rapid-fire succession, what did Job say about the source of these blessings? The Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. So, if this be speaking about Job, and Harold, maybe it could be both. Maybe it could be a dual application. They'd be speaking about the wicked in general, but time and again we have seen them insinuate and imply, accused by implicit argument. They're really talking about Job.
Talking about Job, not
yes. Yes.
But Job had done those things.
Yes.
He had oppressed the poor.
Yes, that's the point.
And that he was none of that's true.
Exactly right.
Well, that's more specific charge of wickedness.
Yes, and I'm using the word insinuation because he's not saying, Job, you have... I mean, he didn't come right out and say that. But I mean, it is words that he has said, yes. But it's more along the lines of an insinuation and accusation by implicit means, rather than saying verbatim, Job, comma, this is what you've done. He had no evidence to say that explicitly. So that's where I'm going with that. Yes, Harold, speak up. Well, that's true. I mean, it's obvious these three men, and again, we've hammered this off the course. These three men think Job needs to do what? Repent. I mean, that's obvious. They think Job's in the wrong. He's committed some wicked act, some sin, and he is in dire need of repentance. So that is their line of thinking. I think that's been established. I'm just looking at different places in the speeches where they seem to be a little more harsh and biting, either in their direct statements or in their implicit accusations. And to me, this is somewhat implicit, again, because They didn't come out and say, Job, this is what you have done. But they're talking about the wicked, and we know they're speaking about Job. I mean, that's what good would it have done to speak about the wicked in general? That would have served no purpose. They're here to help Job, not have discourses on the wicked. That's correct. Now, we're going to find in very short order, someone finally comes out and says, Job, here's what you've done specifically. And it won't take very long to do that, next chapter or so, that there will finally be some specific charges levied. And, of course, they don't have no evidence. Now, would it be hard to find wicked people who have done these things in verse 19? The world's full of them. That's right. So it's not just a discourse on the wicked. They're talking about Job. That's the gist of their argumentation. Okay, so this is Zophar's argument there in verse 19. Now, the inevitable end of the wicked. Of course, where is he headed? Well, you read these ten verses, and this is where Zophar says, because he knew no quiet within him, he does not retain anything he desires, nothing remains for him to devour, his prosperity does not endure. Is that generally true regarding the wicked? More or less it is, yes. In the fullness of his plenty, he'll be cramped. The hand of everyone who suffers will come against him. When he fills his belly, God will send his fierce anger on him, and it will rain it on him while he is eating. If he flees from the iron weapon, verse 24, what's going to get him? Something else will. That's right. You can't escape. And of course, all this wrath is coming from who, according to Zophar? God. So you cannot escape from God. That's really what he's saying. His inability to be content will destroy him. And there's several passages in the Scripture, most notably some come to mind from the book of Ecclesiastes, where we're taught the wealthy who fill themselves up are never satisfied. They just keep wanting more. And that's true of wicked people who live greedy, avarice lifestyles. Prosperity affects him so far, he won't escape the doom from God, and his inability or his iniquity will be revealed in the end. He'll have lost everything. And that's true. If the wicked lives a life full of sin, full of rebellion against God, and he may die a very rich man and not have much trouble in this life. Of course, we need to understand what. The teaching of the Scripture is clear on that. In the end, that's right. He's not going to get away with anything. God will see to that. So, again, like the friends have done, Zophar speaks some things that are true in some respects. But again, they're making the error of applying their logic unfairly to Job without any evidence, without any proof whatsoever. Okay, now let's look at Job's response. Chapter 21, verses 1 through 34. How does Job respond to this? And I'll go ahead and say again, I don't want to be so repetitive, but at the end of chapter 20, that's the last words we hear from Zophar. He won't speak again. He's done. Okay? Now, here we have Job will finally now directly respond. He has been somewhat tactful toward the opening of all these speeches, these dialogues. As it's gone further along in the exchange, Job is getting a little more biting back in his response to them as they've been very cruel to him. But finally, Job will... But in most cases, it seems to me, when the friends have said some things, when Job responds, he more or less just ignores them and just launches out into these speeches about he laments God's not answering. He laments that how he's being treated, accusation against God unfairly. He mentions other things, and he just doesn't really respond directly to what the friends have said. But that changes right here. Job will directly respond to what Zophar has just said, and in other ways, to what has been said previously in the previous speeches by Eliphaz and Bildad. Okay. He requests in verses 2 through 3, saying, look, pay me careful attention. And then he says what in verse 3? After I've spoken, what can you do? You can mock me if you want to. That's fine. I mean, they're going to do it anyway, and Job knows that. But just give me a fair hearing. Listen to what I've got to say. And then when I'm done, you can think, do, say whatever you want to. Starting in verse 4. As for me, the first question he asks is what? All right. Well, what's your verse say, verse 4, Bobby? Read your verse 4 for us. Okay, and then the second part. Right. Job is saying, of course I'm impatient. But his first question is, get what I'm saying. I'm not complaining against who? A man. Who is Job's complaint against? He's complaining against God. Complaining of unfair treatment from Jehovah. He sees this as all from the hand of God. So he says, that's why I'm impatient. That's why I feel vexed somewhat. He's offering some excuses for his voice of complaint and his impatience. Verses 4 through 6. Look at verse 5. Look at me and be astonished, and put your hand over your mouth. Even when I remember, I am disturbed, and horror takes hold of my flesh. Now, starting in verse 7, we see Job responding to the arguments that the friends have made. And look and see if we can make some contrast here. The friends have said basically about the wicked, what's the duration of their life? If we just can... All right. Well, no, what have the friends said? Short-lived. What's Job say? I can show you wickedness, live long. See, now we're going to look at, he's going to expose the generalizations that the friends have made. Both parties are saying things that are true. The friends have argued, oh, the wicked live short. Well, that is true. But we can also find wicked that have lived long. So you can't just make it a blanket rule. The friend's position is, look, if you're wicked, you're going to cut your life off at your knees. You're going to live a short life. Well, that's not always true. That's true in some places, some cases, but not always. So the wicked live, even prosper in power, Job says. And this contradicts, look at what Zophar said, real quickly, chapter 20, verse 11. His bones are full of his youthful vigor. But how much will his youth help him? Not going to help him. See, short life. All right? Job says, verse 8, the wicked see their future offspring. And that's true. Verse 8, their descendants are established with them in their sight, their offspring before their eyes. Look back at chapter 18 and verse 19 real quickly. What had Bildad said? What's it say, Bill? Chapter 18, verse 19. He doesn't get to see him. He doesn't see him. See, that's what Bildad said. But Job says, no, I can show you wicked that they have their posterity in their own sight, right before him. So, obviously, they both can't be right. If you make these hard and fast arguments, well, Bildad can't be right and Job be right too, unless we accept the fact that they have been making generalizations and thus applying it across the board to everybody. And we can't do that when you're discussing things. That's the danger you get into when you make these blanket statements and try to paint everybody the same color with the brush. Yes, Mike. Well, that's true, and that's one of his complaints. Well, that's what we've been stressing with the fact that when they make these arguments based on their theology, they say we get our wisdom from the ancients, from the previous generation. We get our wisdom from visions that God gives us, and we discuss whether actually, Eliphaz's vision came from God. I think we determined that it did not, but he thought it did. But that's the problem that we see in the speeches of the friends. They claimed they were speaking for God, and they were not speaking for God. And they were ignoring evidence around them. Case in point, what you just mentioned, they did not look up with their eyes and see wicked prospering and living long lives. In their mind, look, it's got to be this way. If you're wicked, God won't let you prosper, and you won't live a long life. That's just how it has to be. That's just the way things are in our world. But that's not the case. So they were making up their own evidence, but yet accusing Job without any evidence. And that's the problem in the whole cycle of these speeches. Okay? So here's some direct contradictions of Job to these friends. Look also in verse 9. Job says, I can look and see the wicked's house is safe and secure. Is that what he says? But go back to what Eliphaz says in chapter 5, verse 17 and 24. And he says basically in those two verses that the wicked have no security in their homes. So again, who's right? Well, Job is just exposing them for their generalizations. And then just in a summary statement, he says in these four verses, the wicked enjoy blessings in life. And that's just evident. And that's been contradiction of what all three of them have been saying at one time or another throughout all the speeches. So Job finally responds directly to these statements that they've been making. And is trying to show them. This is why the chapter began the way it did, I believe. He says, listen to me. And when I'm done, you can do what you want. But I'm telling you, things are not as you make them out to be. You have no evidence to support what you've been saying. Here's the evidence to the contrary of what you have been saying. This is down through verse 16. Job is countering these statements. The wicked's blasphemy seemingly goes unpunished. And yet Job concludes in verse 16, but I'm not going to be counted in that number. But that doesn't describe me. That's not the kind of person I am. That's just what he observes, them and their behavior. All right. Now, verses 17 through 34 of chapter 21. He says, I can see that your wisdom is not universally true, and here's more evidence of that. They had argued many times that the wicked are always lights that are snuffed out prematurely, but that isn't always the case. You see, wicked that live long lives. They don't end premature in death. Wicked's offspring do not always suffer for the sins of their predecessors. In fact, what does the Bible teach about that main principle? Like in Ezekiel's prophecy, the son shall not... Yeah, just because someone sinned. Now, if someone sins, can his successors share in consequences of his sin? Is that possible? Sure, it happens all the time, doesn't it? But is it universally true? No, it's not universally true. Not at all. In their world it was, but Job was just saying that's not really the way that it works. That's down through verse 21. Look through verse 26 now. And he says, this is starting in verse verse 22. Can anyone teach God knowledge in that he judges those on high? One dies in his full strength, being wholly at ease and satisfied. His sides are filled out with fat. Marrow of his bones is moist. While another dies with a bitter soul, never even tasting anything good. Together they lie down in the dust, and worms cover them. Here's one man lives a good life, one man lives a deprived life, and they both wind up where? In the ground. And verse 22, Job says, now, who's responsible for all that? Well, that's how God's got it all worked out. And who's going to school God on that? Who's going to say, now, God, why do you have it worked out that way? Job says, that's how God chooses to deal with those two situations. And that's just where that is. And that's true, isn't it? You think any of us today make the same mistakes that Job has made in these speeches? There has been at times he's questioned God's moral control of the universe. He's complained about, as he saw it, God's unfairness. Sometimes we do that too, don't we? We're trying to live a godly, righteous life, living for Christ in the kingdom today, and trouble comes our way, and we look out our front window, and who do we see? Guys across the street, got the foulest mouths on the planet, and they got money coming out their ears and nice cars, and we think what? Well, now wait, just that don't seem right. We can fall victim to that too. In fact, it's either Psalm 73 or 37. I get those two mixed up. Where Asaph says, in vain I've washed my hands in innocence. It didn't do me any good. Sometimes we can think that way too. And Job did that. He's having to be reminded that that isn't how a servant of God is to think about these things. So he has made that complaint also, and he says, God's ruling all this. And he'll see to it that it ends the way it's supposed to end. It's not up for us to question him. Okay. Yes. Yeah, Job is close. Rob makes a good point. Job is close.
Satan uses power to lead astray, but they're not considering where this is coming from.
Well, they don't know. They just assume it.
We know.
Yes, and both parties are assuming. The friends have assumed a certain position, and Job has assumed a certain position. In fact, the matter is, both parties are wrong, aren't they? Nobody's got it right in this exchange. And that's what is so ironic about all this, and helpful to us as students of the book. Okay. Now he concludes this chapter by a summary, if you will, of the arguments of the friends so far. Look in verse 27. He says, "Behold, I know your thoughts and the plans by which you would wrong me." Job's not stupid. He knows they've been insinuating about him the whole time. "You've been talking about me. I know that. For you say," verse 28, "where is the house of the nobleman? And where is the tent, the dwelling place of the wicked?" Another insinuation. Where's Job's house? It's gone. Now, if the wicked had a house, where would his house be? I mean, this is the old A equals B, B equals C, therefore A has to equal C argument. Where's the wicked man's house, according to the French theology? It's gone because of their wickedness. Job, where's your house? "Oh, I think it's gone. Therefore, that must mean what? Job, you're wicked." That's their thinking. And Job says, "I understand you've been saying all along, implicitly, you've been implying, you've been insinuating against me. And I understand that." So he's not stupid in all this. He correctly accuses them of generalizing too much, making improper applications. Look at verse 28. "For you say, where is the house of the noble?" Okay, we read that verse. Verse 29, "Have you not asked wayfaring men?" Verse 30, "The wicked is preserved for the day of calamity. They will be led forth at the day of fury. Who will confront him with his actions, and who will repay him for what he has done? While he is carried to the grave, men will keep watch over his tomb. The clouds of the valley will gently cover him." So forth. What Job seems to be saying there is you've been saying that the wicked will die a painful death because of their wickedness, and then we'll forget them. But these verses seem to give the point that even in their death, wicked men are often thought of. Their tombs are cared for. Verse 33, "The clods of the valley will gently cover him. There'll be daisies growing on his grave. Cemetery will be kept nice and neat where the wicked man is buried." These don't match your statements, your theology about the wicked man. So Job is just simply saying in this chapter, it seems to me, he's trying to counter what they've been implying the whole time. He's just actually saying it, stating it, where they've been implying it and insinuating it all along. Okay? That seems to be what he's saying to me. I could be wrong about that, and there may be other ways to look at it, but that seems to be what he is arguing at this particular junction of the exchange. Verse 34, he concludes by saying, "How then will you vainly comfort me? Because I know what about your arguments." They're false. They're just full of holes. It's like Swiss cheese. There's holes everywhere in what you've said. And you're not comforting me. And again, we make the point. The chapter the book begins. They came to comfort, but they've not stayed to do that. And they've said all these things. We've been through two complete cycles of speeches. And how would you classify these men as comforters? That's what Job said, chapter 16. Sorry. Hurtful. Not just that they're not helping. They're hurting. I mean, that's really what they're doing. And Job sees that. Okay. Anything else through chapter 21? Question or comment someone has? Yes, Trevor. And Job knew that. Yes. Job, that never escaped Job's knowledge. I would say that's correct. Okay. Well, now for the third time, Eliphaz speaks. And in the last cycle of speeches, again, only Eliphaz and Bildad speak, and they only have one chapter apiece. They don't get two chapters, so they don't say as much. I mean, after all we've looked at, What left do they have to say, do you think? They don't have anything new to say. They'd just be like leftovers, warmed over, the same stuff warmed over again. And so they're going to try one more time each to convince their friend of how they see him. This now gets us to page 18 in your handouts, lesson 9. Eliphaz's third speech. Here's his argument. He begins by asking Job some rhetorical questions. Questions that have an obvious answer. Chapter 22. Okay. Look at verse 2. Again, this is the American Standard, how it reads. Can a vigorous man be of use to God? What's the answer to that? Yes. Can a wise man be useful to himself? Yes. Is there any pleasure to the Almighty if you are righteous? That was his question. Or is there any profit if you make your ways perfect? Those don't require a lot of thought. But Eliphaz seems to reason differently than we just did. It seems to me that he believes God has no benefit or no pleasure if Job were righteous. Why ask the question? Yet we learn from Psalm 35, verse 27, that God is pleasured by righteous living. That's what Jehovah wants us to do. He does derive some benefit from that. But he's saying to Job, in rhetoric, in an implied question, not implied, but in an answer that should be easy or implied, there's no benefit if you take your position, Job, what you've been saying. He even states Job must be wicked because God would not do what to a righteous man, verses 4 and 5. What's God doing to you, Job, according to the friends? He's reproving them. God's reproving Job. Verse 4. Is it because of your reverence that he reproves you? Now, the friends know Job has been claiming what the whole time? I'm not guilty. Well, now, Job, we've seen what's happened to you. You've lost your house, you've lost your family, you've lost all your possessions, all this, you've lost your health. And, of course, they're again convinced this is from the hand of God. So his argument is, why would God have done all this to you if you were righteous? Why would God be reproving you if you were a righteous man? Well, the answer to that is what? Obviously, God wouldn't be doing that if Job were righteous. But again, they're making the same mistake Job has been making. They're assuming all these things have come from God. So on that point, Job and the friends are alike. They see that the source is from heaven. It's all divine. It's all from a divine source. So he's going back to his old arguments again. Job had earlier asked for specific proof of his sin. Chapter 6, verse 24. He said, show me my error. Okay, Eliphaz, finally, somebody in this group finally will give some specific charges. Chapter 21. Look at verses 6 through 9. Look at what Eliphaz says Job is guilty of. Now, look at it carefully. He doesn't say, the wicked do these things. The wicked does this. The pronoun he uses is you. Job, here's what you've done. All right, Trevor, would you read for us, please, verses 6 through 9? Let's stop at verse 9. Well, now, what do you see as the problem with those words? How do we know they're false? Bill says they're all false. Well, how do we know that? Okay. Let's go back to the first of the book. God gave a testimonial, but God said something about Job. There's my servant Job. Have you considered him? There's none like him. He's blameless, upright, reveres God, so forth. But now Eliphaz says, what have you done to the widows? What about if you've taken, what was a pledge? Verse 6 says, you've taken pledges of your brothers without cause. What's a pledge? Yes. I see this as a direct accusation against Job. Well, that's what that's what Eliphaz thinks.
Yes.
But the problem is he has no proof. But what I'm asking is, just in a general sense, in the days of the Bible, the days of the Scripture, what was a pledge? Okay, and what usually was given in pledge, and in fact the law spoke about this, your cloak or your garment. And if someone gave you their cloak or a garment as a pledge, what the law say you have to do every night? Give it back to him. Why, Brother Buford? Well, that's all he's got. He's got to stay warm. Well, he says you've taken pledges of your brothers without cause. Well, that's just, now, if that's what happened, let's play the assuming games for a moment. Let's say Job, there was ample proof that Job really did do that. Now, of course, he did not. But let's just say, for sake of argument, that's what he did. How would you classify that kind of behavior? I'm sorry? Okay. What verse, Wayne? Okay. All right. Yes. But someone who takes a pledge without cause, that's just not nice. That's downright mean. That's hateful, spiteful, unloving. To think so little about your brother. What about the accusation, the last part of verse 7? From the hungry you have withheld bread. That's terrible for a person to do that. Verse 9, you sent widows away. The downtrodden, those who are helpless. Now again, this is what Eliphaz is saying. Job, here, okay, you want proof? Here's what I know you've done. Well, the high-minded thing in all this was Eliphaz didn't have an ounce of proof. And again, I'm coming down pretty hard on him, because he does not say the wicked do these things. He says you. He applies this directly to Job. You have done these things. That's why God is reproving you. Again, connect this back up to verse 4. Is this because you're so righteous and so reverential that God reproves you? No, you're guilty of these kinds of things. So Eliphaz launches out there. He's out on that limb now, and he says, here's what I know you've done. So he's giving proof, if you will. So as a result, verses 10 through 11... Therefore, he says, as a result of what you've done, what's he say is around you? Snares, darkness, and abundance of water. So that's why you're in the mess you're in. You're just like walking through a big minefield of traps and snares. You don't have a chance. You don't have a prayer, Job. God's got you. God's going to get you because of what you've done. Okay, we have to stop here for lack of time. But again, notice we've taken a slightly different turn in the argument. There's nothing new being said, but the approach is a little different now than we've had in the past. It's always been implied. Generalizations have been used the whole time, but starting here, Eliphaz has taken the gloves off, and he's really hitting Job full force with specific charges, but he has no proof. He has no evidence. So, more things for Job to have to endure. Okay, we will pick up in verse 12, which puts us on page 18, question 3, Lord willing, on Sunday morning. Thank you all for your attention tonight.